Even if you have just a small patch of garden space, or maybe even just a room for a few pots on a patio or balcony, I'm betting that you may plant some veggies every year, at least some tomatoes. It can be really satisfying to plant. You know, sometimes it's even great. I sometimes even now start things from seeds. Sometimes I'll plant them from seeds in the ground. And I'm hoping, and just like you probably, to end up with some succulent tomatoes or some delicious salad greens or whatever. It's all for the better. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Favorite time of the week for me. John Hendrickson, one of our guests today, is with the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. He's an outreach specialist for fresh market veggies and food systems and coordinates the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. And John, thanks for coming back.
Happy to be here, Larry.
Yeah, great to have you back with us. Also with us today, Aaron Silva, who's an associate scientist in the Department of Agronomy at the UW-Madison in the College of Ag and Life Sciences, and she specializes in organic gardening and farming. And Aaron, welcome to Garden Talk.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. You know, somebody asked me, when was it? It wasn't that long ago. Somebody said, what really is organic gardening? And I, you know what? There's, if you look at the it's confusing. It's really confusing if you look at organic, you know, labels and so forth, the different meanings behind them. Some things that look like they might be organic but aren't. So I guess my question to you is, what's organic? What is an organic garden?
Sure. And I've heard the same comment that particularly with organic gardening versus organic farming, there's a whole range of practices that a gardener can employ. When you go to the grocery store and see organic produce, there is a federal organic standard. So if something is sold with that either green or black USDA organic label, a consumer can be confident that the farmer growing that produce has followed the practices that are set forth by the national organic standard. So as a consumer buying an organic product, you definitely can feel a level of confidence that that grower is growing organically. But as an organic gardener, I've definitely heard different gardeners employ a whole range of practices that incorporate some of organic techniques, like organic fertility practices, using compost and cover crops, using organic pest management, different pesticides that are allowable under the organic regulation. So there are a whole range of practices, and as a gardener, that you can incorporate into your gardening plans.
So there's a lot you can do, and I, you know, probably for a lot of people who are listening today, there may be people who employ a lot of what you would consider to be organic practices, but then there may be one or two things that aren't maybe considered organic, technically speaking, or otherwise, that they follow to.
Yeah, I know some gardeners might use a herbicide to make sure that they have their weeds knocked down, or might use a conventional fertilizer, but then might incorporate some organic insecticides or other organic practices, which have benefits to soil health and to the environment. So there's definitely a whole range of approaches that a gardener can use.
Yeah. And John, you've got your own farm and garden system going.
Yeah, my farm is certified organic, has been for, gosh, I'm actually not sure how many years it's been. And one thing that's important is that the standards, you know, they can change. There are new products that come on board, and those have to be either approved or disapproved for organic. So that's why it's important for a farm, the farms that are certified, they get those updates on an annual basis about the materials that they can and can't use.
Yeah, that makes good sense. We have callers online. You can join in too, by the way. Do you grow vegetables just for your family or maybe to sell? Do you have a favorite veggie variety you want to share with us? I've got a few that I really like. Have you gone through the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers? We're going to talk about that today as well. And we'd certainly, if you've done that, haven't gone through that school, I'd love to hear from you and your experiences. And I'm sure John would and Aaron would as well. So give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org Or you can post on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show and do it right there. Paul in Dubuque, Iowa, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I've moved from my old home, which I grew a garden in the backyard, and I had really, really good soil. Now, my new home, I've got clay, and my question is, should I raise the garden or should I work with the clay?
Well, one question would be is how big of an area are you going to tackle, which would be, you know, lead you in one direction or another. If you're going to farm or garden a really large area, you may just want to work with what you've got. If it's going to be a relatively small area, building raised beds would be a great way to go. One thing that I hear a number of people suggest to people who have clay soils is to, you know, you think you want to get away from the clay, so you want to kind of go to the opposite. And when people think of the opposite of clay, they often think of sand. And so they think maybe I should add sand to my soil. That's actually one of the worst things that you can do to a clay soil is to add sand. It's kind of a great way to make concrete. Another thing that would be really important for you in terms of farming with clay soils is to be very careful about your tillage and working the soil and not working the soil when it's really wet and not overworking the soil. You can, you know, rent or own, if you own a rototiller, you can, you know, if you till when your soil's too wet, you can create a real big crusting problem on the top and at the bottom of the tiller as well. You can create a hard pan, which is going to be hard on your plants. Generally, adding organic matter to your soils is going to be, should be an emphasis for you. Whether that's adding compost or tilling under cover crops.
And I guess one other thing that I would consider, and I wholeheartedly agree with John, that adding compost or looking at cover crops is definitely going to work in your favor. But another thing I'd consider with respect to the decision of doing raised beds is perhaps how well drained that area is. Clay soil can hold water, so particularly in the spring or at times where there's heavy rains, it could be more difficult for that area to drain. And if that isn't a low-lying area or an area that's more difficult to drain, I would definitely consider perhaps going to the raised bed route, particularly if you're growing a fairly small area.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call.
One final comment about that is that one thing you might want to consider is actually doing both. You know, the point about the clay soil being poorly drained can be a problem when it's too wet in the spring, but it can be to your advantage in a dry time when that ground actually does have moisture. So you could build some raised beds, a raised bed or two for early spring plantings and maybe use the unraised part for later season crops.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul, thank you. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Gail in Wauwatosa next. Gail, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, coming up, I'd like to try a couple new different crops, vegetables. One is artichokes and the other fava beans, but I don't see either, well, artichokes maybe, but not fava beans in the markets very often. So I'm just wondering if Wisconsin is a place that they will grow well.
Mm. I cannot. Every time I hear fava beans, I think of The Silence of the Lambs.
The movie. Boy, I didn't watch that movie.
Oh well, I won't go into how it's used in the movie, Gail. But if you ever see the movie, you'll never be able to think of fava beans in quite the same way.
Oh my maybe goodness. Maybe I won't watch it.
Well, aside from that, let's talk about fava beans and artichokes. Fava beans in particular, can we grow them? Erin, what do you think?
I have not had a lot of experience growing artichokes. My impression is that Wisconsin has a bit too short of a growing season to grow artichokes. I don't know if there are certain varieties that may be more adapted to Wisconsin, maybe require a shorter growing season. But I do think, particularly without having access to the right variety, they would be a difficult crop to grow.
Yeah, both of them are...
Fava beans, too?
Yeah, both of them are warm season, longer season crops. You can. I do know folks who have grown artichokes in Wisconsin. It can be done.
Yeah.
I believe that Johnny Selected Seeds has a variety of artichoke that is geared more towards northern areas. it does require that you would start that plant indoors and get it started and transplant it so that it has a long enough season to do its thing. I do not have any direct experience with growing them, however. Just with eating them.
Do you know how long prior, or how early I should start the artichokes indoors? Because we definitely start our seeds indoors.
All right. John, have you got an idea about that? I don't have right off the top of my head, but I'm sure John's going to have something for us. And while he's thinking about it, I'm going to mention that you can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. You can also go to our Facebook page, and especially if you've got some nice garden photos, maybe either flowers or vegetables, we'd love to see those on the Facebook page. Our Facebook page is titled The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page, The Larry Mueller Show. And if you click on that, you're going to be able to go there. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org with your questions or comments. So look forward to all of those. And John, what do you think?
On the artichokes, I would recommend planting those as much as 8 to 12 weeks before your last spring frost date. In Wauwatosa, that's probably a similar frost date to last frost date to here in Madison. So you're starting them quite early.
Last frost date is what, for end of May, probably?
Yeah, mid to late May.
And southern Wisconsin.
So you're going to be starting those, you know, as much as 2 months or 3 months earlier than that.
And with these varieties, I'd expect a smaller blossom and less meaty leaves, so they won't be quite the same as what you'd find in a grocery store. I'm sure the flavor would be outstanding, but they definitely would be a bit smaller and a bit less meaty than you might otherwise have purchased in the past.
Well, thank you.
Yep, thanks, Gail. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Again, you can join in as well at 1-800-642-1234, talking about gardening, and especially vegetable gardening today. And we're going to get into the School for Beginning Market Growers as well. John leads that group, and it's going to be fun to talk about that, too. The number again, 1-800-642-1234. John Hendrickson with the Center for Integrated Ag Systems, and also with us today, Aaron Silva, Associate Scientist in the Department of Agronomy at the UW-Madison College of Ag and Life Sciences. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, Patty Nagai joins us again, UW Extension Horticulture Educator. That's coming up next week on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. It's always fun to have her with us. Right now, though, a couple of great guests as well to talk about vegetable gardening and also the School for Beginning Market Growers, John Hendrickson and Aaron Silva. And I've been introducing Aaron incorrectly here. I've been saying she's an associate scientist. Actually, she's an assistant professor in the Department of Plant Pathology. So, and I guess that the title that I was giving you was your previous title.
Yes, it was.
So we were just a little late with the, all right. We've got it now, though. Assistant professor in the Department of Plant Pathology. And I bet Jeff in Dorchester, Iowa has some good news in the artichoke area. Hi.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Oh, sure. One quick suggestion on your Facebook page. It would be helpful to some of us if you spelled your last name.
Oh, I should do that. Yeah,
you should. At any rate, my wife and I operate on a large-scale gardening. We do enough to actually operate a small CSA, and we like to experiment annually with a couple of small patches on different crops. Last year, we did a plant called cardoon that serves as a wonderful substitute for artichokes. Now, I live for 30 years near Castroville, California, which is the artichoke capital of the world. And if I think these things are close, then they're pretty darn close.
Oh, cardoon.
Cardoon, C-A-R-D-O-O-N.
And it is popular in Italian cuisine. And I'm also trying to think, is it a stalk?
It's very thistle-like.
And I was going to say,
one of ours got almost 7 feet tall, and the stalk was 17 inches around at the bottom, and you cut it at the base, kind of like a giant stalk of celery.
Yeah.
And then you can braise, saute, steam those pieces, and they are very artichoke-like.
You know, I hadn't thought about that. There's an Italian friend who would make, when the thistles, certain thistles would begin to grow in the spring, he would harvest them, and he always called them cardoonies.
Yeah, there you go.
And he would bread them often.
Another thing that grows wild that I found similar in the past is young milkweed pods, especially the common variety, the one you find in the ditches. And mm-hmm. Don't take all the pods, just harvest a couple of them when they're about 2 inches long, no longer than that. And you can steam them or saute them in butter and olive oil. And that's somewhat like an artichoke.
All right. But the cardoon, I could see where that certainly would be the case.
Yeah, and it is a very good vegetable.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff.
You bet.
Appreciate the call. And I got to believe, I know they would grow here, although we just, well, here again is another vegetable that you just don't see much. For some reason, it's never really been grown here in Wisconsin very much. Roger and Toma, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Okay, here's what I got on my mind. I've got about a 600 to 700 square foot garden down below my house. I love to plant potatoes. I plant half red and half white, but in the last 2 years, I have gotten nothing but scabby potatoes. And I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
One thing that can help prevent scab is making sure that your potatoes are well irrigated. They actually get more scabby when they're in drought conditions. So has your location been dry the last 2 years?
Well, yes, but right below my house, I've got a canal that goes way up beyond my house where the owner of the property around my house has a cranberry marsh, and I have a pump down there, so irrigation is no problem. Now, I don't know if maybe I'm not watering them enough or not.
A scab is a bacteria that's found. Scab is caused by a bacteria that's found in the soil. So crop rotation is definitely another practice that can help growing potatoes outside of that area. And there are varieties of potatoes that are more resistant and tolerant to scab. So if you know you have scab in that area, it's good to choose a variety that is resistant, if not tolerant, or at least tolerant, if not resistant. As Larry said, it's hard to imagine right now thinking about gardening, but this is actually a fun time of year to look through seed catalogs and look at varieties. And through the efforts of plant breeding, there's a lot of different disease resistances that are present in different vegetables. And with organic farming, definitely thinking ahead and knowing what diseases and insects are a problem and trying to identify resistant varieties is really key. So, it's being a soil-borne organism that does overwinter, it's best to try to rotate out of that area and choose varieties that are resistant or tolerant to that organism.
Okay, I'll try that. Just one more other thing I'd like to mention.
Sure.
My garden is probably about 25 feet below the drain system on my septic system. Would that have anything to do with it?
I can't imagine it would have anything to do with it.
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, what I'm going to do then, I have a seed catalog. I'm going to get it out and look at it, and I'll try a different scab-resistant variety this year and see what happens.
Yeah, I think that would be a great plan.
Thanks, Raj.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And back to cardoon for a minute. Judith checked the Wisconsin Master Gardener resources, and she's going to post the Wisconsin Master Gardener page about growing cardoon up on our Facebook page, which is cool. So if you want to learn about it, please go to our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Judith said, hey, it's a lovely ornamental as well, which is, that never hurts either. nice to have something nice to look at and eat as well. Heather in Fort Atkinson. By the way, before we go to Heather, we have open lines, and you can get on pretty quickly with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can still email us at talk@WPR.org and post your photos and questions as well on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. And our last caller is right. I should just spell my name more often. It's M-E-I-L-L-E-R. M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And if you forget that, again, if you go to Wisconsin Public Radio, WPR.org, and you'll see my name right there, and you can click on it there. Heather in Fort Atkinson, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering what to do about squash bugs. I've changed the location of my pumpkins and squash every year, and I've tried to use just the Go Green, I think it's called, or just soap and water to kill them, but I'm always overrun every year. And I'm just kind of running out of options that are organic.
Yeah, those are a tough pest to manage. And I find in my own research plots that squash and cucurbits, cucumbers, zucchinis, they're really hard with respect to cucumber beetles and squash bugs and getting those managed appropriately. You definitely can try.
I was going to say, how big's your area? Is it a large?
Well, I have about a quarter of an acre, but I only garden maybe an eighth of that.
Oh, you know, you could cover that.
Yeah, I use row cover to cover my plantings in the squash family early in the season. You eventually have to pull those covers off because those fruits need to be the flowers need to be pollinated, so you get good fruit set. One of my favorite crops is cucumbers, and I grow a Japanese variety of cucumber, and the variety that I grow is parthenocarpic, and parthenocarpic varieties produce fruit without pollination. They're self-pollinating flowers.
Oh.
So with my Japanese varieties, I've actually started growing those inside a enclosed structure so that I can keep those darn cucumber beetles away.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, but that is fairly inexpensive. Those row covers are cheap. I mean, you can get, I don't know how many, I forget what the cost is now, but it's pretty inexpensive and certainly worth a try.
You know, it's at least kind of least fun task in a garden.
Yeah.
You know, to go out and do the little the two-finger method of pest control. You're squishing bugs between your fingers, but you know, on a small scale in a home garden, you know, being out there and staying on top of that kind of daily chores.
Another good idea. That's another good idea. And you can always, you can just knock them off into a can with soapy water, too. You don't have to squeeze them. There you go. All right. You can join in, too. Again, 1-800-642-1234. I have been talking about the School for Beginning Market Growers, or at least mentioning it, and we haven't given you any of the details. And John, maybe talk a little bit about that school. Who's it for? And it's coming up. I know that.
That's right. It's a 3-day intensive program for people that want to start growing vegetables and selling them, marketing them in, at the local farmers market or community supported agriculture, or perhaps selling to retail stores or restaurants. It's a program that we've run since 1998. And we run it every year in January.
It's coming. Been very successful.
Yes. We've been running it for a long time, and it's coming up next weekend, the Friday, Saturday, Sunday program, the 9th, 10th, and 11th.
Yeah. Is it sold out, or are there?
No, we still have room.
So how do people get involved with it?
Well, we have a Facebook page as well. Perhaps we can
We may have it already up on our School for Beginning Market Growers, that's up on our Facebook page. So if you want to go to learn more about signing up for it, go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we'll give you a direct link to the School for Market Gardeners. So it's 3 days?
Correct.
It's a bit. So it's a big. So
it's a commitment, but you know, if you're going to start a business, best to do it right. Best to have things in order and get a business plan together and know what you're heading into.
And it's and what days are they again now?
It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday next week.
Next week. So here you go. Still time for you to get involved with it, and we'll probably talk a little bit more about some of the specifics as we go along. Erin, do you ever get involved with that or not?
This is the first year I will be involved. I'll be giving a talk about post-harvest handling and food safety on the Sunday of that course.
All right, so lots of really great topics, and we'll spice up the show as we move along here with some more of those topics. So, Carol in Sun Prairie up next. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have an answer to the scabby potato question.
Okay.
The soil is too high in pH. Potatoes like it a bit more acid. If he just drops a half a teaspoon or a teaspoon of soil sulfur in with each seed potato when he plants it, it'll be a lot better.
Ah.
And if he keeps doing that year after year, he'll be fine.
Well, I tell you what, Erin, you're nodding yes.
That lower acidity or soils that are a bit more acid do tend to be less prone to scab. A lot of our soils in Wisconsin now are deficient in sulfur because of our efforts to clean the air. We actually have less sulfur coming down with rain, so there is less sulfur available in the soil as well. So adding sulfur is not necessarily a bad thing in that respect either. And with all gardening, it doesn't hurt to get a soil test and see where your pH is at and where your fertility is at, which is a pretty easy thing to do through the UW soil testing labs, fairly inexpensive, at about $15, $25, I think. So, but yes, she is correct that lower pH soils do tend to be less prone to scab.
Carol, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, good tips. Cindy in Gays Mills, it's your turn. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, thanks for hopefully helping me with my sweet corn problem. I've been gardening in the same area for many years, but the last 4 years I've had very poor production on my sweet corn. The outside rows tend to produce what I would consider normally 1 to 2 ears per stalk. The inside rows only produce on the 1 or 2 end stalks of each row. We've done a soil test and apparently don't have any fertility or pH issues. I've talked to some master gardeners and some extension agents, and nobody has a real good answer for me yet. And we've tried growing at least 4 different varieties, a bicolor, a yellow, a blue corn, and we have the same problem with everything.
And again, describe the problem again. It's so you get good growth on the ends?
We get good production. I mean, the growth looks fine. All the stalks will be about the same height, but our actual production of ears of corn is only on the outside rows or the ends of the inside rows. So it would seem to me it's
sunlight issue.
How large of a planting are we talking about here?
It varies, but they're always more than the 8 rows in width.
So 8 rows in width?
Well, before you asked your full question, I was assuming that it was a size of the planting question, because you do need a sizable block of corn to produce an effective amount of corn because of how the corn, the pollen drops from the tops of the plants and needs to hit the silks in order to produce good production. So I was thinking it was the size of the planting.
Are you seeing ears but just not kernel fill? Are you
We don't get the ears.
No, any ears.
We tassel, but we don't seem to get silks on the inside stalks.
I know there's a lot of insects that loves to eat the silks. Are you having, are the silks there, but are getting devoured by it's the corn root worm that turns into the little, it looks like a cucumber beetle, but it's all greenish yellow?
Yeah, we don't see those.
Really?
And we're not seeing the silks.
I could ship you plenty from my farm.
Huh. Yeah. So are you seeing ears but no silks, or you're not even seeing ears on those stalks?
We're not seeing the ears on those stalks.
What's your fertility like? I mean, are these plants getting really tall? And
I wouldn't say they're real tall, but we have a soil that, is one of the highest fertility soils generally in the county, and everything else in the garden does fine. We do apply manure periodically.
Corn is requires a lot of nitrogen, and a soil test won't typically tell you your level of nitrogen, although it will tell you the level of other nutrients. So as I think Larry was suggesting, I would wonder if they were getting enough nitrogen. They are one of the heavier feeders in your garden with respect to that nutrient.
And would that affect the production as I'm seeing it?
I mean,
it certainly could.
Okay.
I'm not saying it's a guaranteed solution, but I think it's the best solution we've come up with so far.
If you've tried several different varieties and still see this issue, I'm a little
stumped on
this one.
I wonder if our colleague Bill Tracy would have an answer.
Who's that?
Oh, Bill's an agronomist at the UW-Madison, professor in agronomy.
Okay.
Correct, and a sweet corn breeder.
And he's a sweet corn breeder.
You can try that.
You could. His name's Bill Tracy, and if you went, I don't have his email address, but I bet if you sent him an email, he's a good guy. He definitely would respond to an email. But you could just go, if you went online to the University of Wisconsin-Madison Department of Agronomy, you're going to get his email address.
Absolutely. All right, we'll try that.
Yeah, his name's Bill Tracy. All right, thanks very much for calling. That is a strange one. You know, it sounded like she's doing everything right. Well, Dawn in the UP, we'll go to you next. Hi, Dawn.
Hi, I live in the UP in the Zone 3, and I have a disturbing observation on cardoon, which I started growing over 2 years ago. The second year, it came up by itself in the same straight line that I had planted it. And it produced those little bulbs on top, those little flowers. I cut them all off so that the seed would not spread. Because I'm afraid with the inexperience of it in this country, it might be a perennial. And if that's the case, we have to be careful of the species that take over.
Oh, an invasive species.
Invasive species. I'm afraid that might be it. And if it is, then I don't want to put a rototiller over that area because that'll send little chunks everywhere. The reason I think it's a perennial is that it grew in a straight line, and it was the first thing to come up in the spring.
Yeah, it is thistle-like. In that it's one of the first things that comes up in spring. Now, I know there are some varieties that are perennials. In fact, Judith was noting to me that there are Seed Savers Exchange carries five varieties of cartoon seeds.
Uh-oh.
And some are perennials, but not all. So you
can
get...
if they are perennial, what's a safe way to get rid of it? I don't want to put chemicals on my garden soil because it's an organic garden and I do sell from it.
Well, then the only other way I can think of is to smother it.
To keep the sun from getting at it, you mean?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. John, is that what you would do if you had to get rid of something? I would cover it with either a white clear plastic or maybe black plastic.
And, okay, I will try that this spring.
Yeah, and you might be able to burn it out over a two-year period or so.
Otherwise, if it's not that small of an area, actually try to dig out the plants.
Yeah, dig it out. And
now, that's the other way. If you can dig it out without, you know, sort of, breaking up the roots.
Well, and digging it out is usually a multiple year process because
you're
not going to get everything. But maybe that section of the garden is set aside for an aggressive plant removal phase over the next few years.
Mm-hmm. And again, you can look. Seed Savers Exchange does have varieties of cardoon that are not perennial, and I guess that's probably something that. Anybody else who is interested maybe in growing it would probably not want to have a perennial. Yeah, it's sort of like, I planted horseradish once, and that was probably the biggest mistake I ever made in the garden. You can't get rid of it once it's, it just goes. It goes, and it grows, and You will never run out of it once you once you plant it. I tell you that. Dawn, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it. You can join in too. The number 1-800-642-1234. I have open lines for you at that 1-800-642-1234. Hank in Brentwood, your turn next. Hi, Hank. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I used what I thought was an organic weed killer in my garden last year, and it turned out to be about the wimpiest garden I've ever planted. The tomatoes were terrible, beets, everything just was terrible. And I'm wondering what would be a good way to revitalize that soil. I've been told wood ash works really good.
What did you use?
Yeah,
you...
What product did you use?
Well, it was a product I found off the internet. It had Epsom salts in a little dish liquid, a little water.
You don't have to go any further. Epsom salts.
It really did a number on the soil.
Yeah, if you did more than what the recommendation called for, you could really do some long-term, have some long-term problems with that soil. At least that's the experience I've been told from other people who have called the show to complain about it. So, and I don't know, John, have you ever had any experience?
Well, I certainly have not used those products, so I don't have any direct experience. You know, I guess you're looking at adding organic matter, compost, doing cover cropping, probably setting that area aside for soil building over the next few years.
Oh, really?
I know somebody used that soil on their lawn, or that material on her lawn, and it killed everything. Killed the entire lawn.
4 hours.
Wow. Huh.
Yeah, it killed everything. And she thought if a little was good, a lot would be better. And so she put more on than was necessary. Or that, you know, it's not a rec. It's not. I'm pretty sure there's no University of Wisconsin recommendation for
it. Yeah, a product like that, you know, would be something that you might want to use, like on a patio area, you know, to get rid of weeds between your paving stones and stuff like that. But that's. I don't believe those products are really geared towards using in a vegetable or flower garden.
Now, if you want to, I suppose one way to resolve the issue, there's different ways you could probably resolve it. One way is probably doing a lot of watering.
That's what I was just going to say. You know, doing a lot of watering may leach out some of those compounds.
Wash the salts
out.
Yeah.
Otherwise, like John said, adding organic matter to... dilute the soil, I think, would help as well. And getting a soil test and just understanding more of what you're working with respect to fertility and salinity. But those are the positives.
Yeah, if you do send a soil test in, you may want to include a note or speak with someone at the soil testing lab and describe what the situation that you're dealing with, so they can make some recommendations.
Wood ash, I would not put wood ash down.
I wouldn't do anything until you get a soil test and try to wash some of these salts out and add some organic matter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And if you might want to just go for some raised beds for a little while too in some areas.
Yeah, that would be a good solution as well.
Yeah, if you want to continue growing something in the meantime, build yourself a nice high raised bed and fill it with some good soil.
Yep. There you go. Good luck, Hank. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking about gardening today, and particularly the vegetable garden, with our two guests, John Hendrickson and Aaron Silva from the University of Wisconsin-Madison College of Ag and Life Sciences. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, John Hendrickson from the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems, Aaron Silva, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Plant Pathology at the UW-Madison, formerly associate scientist in the Department of Agronomy. She's got lots of great experiences to share, as does John, of course. And looking forward to hearing from you. At open lines, we'll get you on right away at 1-800-642-1234. Do you grow vegetables? ask some questions about it. Have some issues they had last year that you'd like to ask about. Maybe you've got a favorite veggie variety to share. Love to hear from you. Again, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Leanne, caller Leanne says that she has successfully grown fava beans. We were talking about fava beans earlier in Greene County. But she, you know, she says, pay attention to the length of the growing season where you are. And that's kind of what you guys were talking about. You need a little bit longer growing season than most of us.
You know, in regards to that length of growing season, I mean, beans are not something that you normally think about transplanting. But if your season isn't short, it is short.
Yeah.
One way to lengthen it is to start crops indoors and transplant them. And you can transplant beans. You know, it's not something you do on a farm scale because it would, you know, the economics doesn't necessarily make sense. But at a garden scale, you know, start your beans indoors and then put them out in the garden.
Yeah. Or get yourself some sort of greenhouse type situation outside. I have a friend. I mentioned this one other time on the show, but I think it's worth mentioning again. A friend who purchased an old boat hoist. And he took the insides out, and then so then he had this nice frame that he then covered with the plastic. And boy, you should see his. It's a wonderful growing place for him in his backyard.
That's a great use for. I used to live along Beaver Dam Lake in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, and I used to drive or walk through my neighborhood and see all those boat house frames, and I always thought that would make a great greenhouse structure.
Well, and so it does. I can tell you it does. I'm firsthand experience looking at Chuck Johnson's boat hoist greenhouse, the old boat hoist greenhouse. It works wonderfully. Okay, let's see. We have. Dave said that when he went to harvest his Brussels sprouts and broccoli, they all had small green worms in them. He'd like to know how to prevent it next year, and how bad is it if he accidentally eats one?
Well, it's just rather unpleasant. The taste isn't great,
yeah.
Or the texture in your mouth. There's a whole host of little green worms that love to eat the cabbage family of crops. And one of the best solutions is to use a product, and this is an organic approved product, a product called BT. BT stands for Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a little bacteria that the little worms ingest and basically dissolves their gut and causes them to die. So a spraying program of BT is a product you can buy in most garden centers these days. Another product you can use is the row cover to keep the It's the little white and yellow butterflies, moths that you see fluttering around your garden that lay the eggs and cause those little green worms. So you can keep those off your plants by using row cover.
Yep. The tough thing with Brussels sprouts, like we mentioned with a couple of those other crops, is they are a longer season crop. So it takes, unlike broccoli or cauliflower, it's just a long time you need to control those worms, which can be tough. And like John mentioned, there are some organic products that can be used that are very safe, BT being one. Another one, that spinosyn-based product, can also be used for those pests. But like most organic pesticides, they do go away very quickly in sunlight. They disintegrate in sunlight. So you do have to spray regularly for them. You have to be on a regular spray regime if you are seeing those pests in your garden. And it's best to spray in the evening, particularly if you know the next day is going to be cloudy and not rainy, because a longer period of time you have where those compounds are on the plant but not exposed to the sunlight, the longer chance the insect has to eat them and then be killed by the compound. So yeah, there are some great alternatives, but Brussels sprouts, the long growing season, you just have to be really diligent.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you very much for that question. Ray in Genoa City, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Hey, we put about a yard of mushroom compost from a local mushroom farm on our garden every year. Our garden's about 15 by 25. And we just do a variety of household, you know, tomatoes, cucumbers, and the like in it. Any long-term problems with mushroom compost or anything like that? And I'll hang up and listen off the air.
I can't imagine what there would be for a problem. You can't use any. I'm sure they're not using any probably chemicals for growing the mushrooms.
Yeah, with compost, I mean, generally compost are a great addition. They add organic matter, particularly with well-composted product where you're not seeing a lot of solid material or wood or decomposed matter that can tie up nitrogen. They are a great way to continually add nutrients to the soil. If you are getting municipal compost, there are some situations where the herbicide may persist and carry over. With mushroom compost, I can't imagine that being an issue. As long as there's not other additives to that mushroom compost that might contribute to increasing salinity, I think overall adding compost on a yearly basis is a great way to enhance your soil health and soil quality.
Yeah, the only thing I would add is to maybe just not just add it as a matter of course, but to do a soil test periodically to figure out if you actually need it.
Yeah.
You could be building up too much phosphorus in your soil or over time by excessively adding too much compost.
Like these even with manure or compost, you can get too much nitrogen or too much phosphorus that has detrimental impacts on our groundwater or surface water quality. So it is a good idea to do a soil test every few years to make sure that you're not getting excessive amounts of these nutrients in your garden.
Pete in Waterford up next. Hey, Pete, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me. I was thinking about the guy with the clay soil, and last year I did straw bale gardening.
Yep.
And it was fantastic, and when it was all through by, let's say, the 1st of September or so, those straw bales had collapsed down into almost all real good compost, and all he'd have to do is till that in, and he's got a good start on getting his clay soil loosened up.
You know, I've done some straw bale gardening the last couple of years, and I've had just great success with it. We're eating tomatoes in November yet from the straw bale, so from the straw bale garden. So, and Judith was pointing out too, the fellow with the Epsom salts issue could use straw bales as well. And I don't know, have you guys experimented with straw bale gardening?
I'm not familiar with that
technique. Oh, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. And it's
dirt cheap.
Yeah, and it's cheap. That's right. You literally don't spend a whole lot of money. I mean, you're buying some straw bales. I mean, the main thing is to find bales that, like I did this last year, that where there are no weeds seeds and no weeds in the straw bales themselves. The year before, I didn't have quite as good luck, but yeah, it's a great system. And Pete, thanks for reminding us about it.
You bet.
Appreciate the call. So it involves those straw bales, wetting those straw bales down for like, oh, I think it was only 10 days or 14 days to kind of get them going in the right state. You want them starting to compost or to, you know, disintegrate a little bit. And you do, frankly, you do put some commercial fertilizer in there. So, or you could use non-commercial as well, but it involves a little fertilizer in with the straw bales. But I had, especially tomatoes, I had great success with tomatoes and with, I had squash. I had some buttercup squash growing out of the side of the bales and the tomatoes growing out of the top of the bales, and things went pretty well. Jill in Rice Lake, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. I think I might have heard this on your show, and I haven't researched it yet. Last fall, somebody had a show on pumpkins, and they mentioned a cheese pumpkin, and it's only named cheese pumpkin because it's shaped like a big round of cheese. It's kind of flat and round. So I went looking for one and found one at the St. Paul Farmers Market, and I have to tell you, it was wonderful. I baked it down, and it was so smooth. It has such a fine meat or flesh, made fantastic pumpkin desserts. So I plan to look and see if I can grow it here and plant cheese pumpkins this next summer. So does anybody, are you familiar with those at all?
Wow, yeah, I guess we have John. If you're a little familiar?
I'm familiar with them. I've not grown them, but it's a great variety.
Yeah.
And if you get them at a Minnesota farmer's market, you ought to be able to grow them.
Oh, sure.
You know, in Minnesota.
Just about any winter squash variety or squash variety is going to be fine to grow in our area. Look at your options in terms of the seed catalogs, and you may want to try a few different types.
Oh, it was really superb. And also, I want to second all of your accolades for the straw bale gardening. That is wonderful, too. So that's all.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And thanks for the reminder about the cheese pumpkin. I might have to stick one of those in my straw bale and one of my straw bales and see what happens with it growing in a straw bale. That will be a lot of fun to try. Cheese pumpkin. Wow. John Hendrickson, one of our guests today. John is with the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems. He's the outreach specialist for fresh market vegetables and food systems and coordinates the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. Go on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you'll find out how you can sign up for that program. It starts next week, as a matter of fact, on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, those 3 days. Erin Silver, our guest as well. Great to have her along. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Plant Pathology. Here for Garden Talk. Thanks for listening on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this edition of Garden Talk. We're zeroing in on vegetables with our two guests, John Hendrickson with the Center for Integrated Ag Systems and the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison, and also Erin Silva, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Horticulture in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. Great to have both of them along, and thank you so much for listening in. Questions about your garden, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. And we have Lisa in Madison with a question. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I've been in Madison for several years, and I have a pretty big urban garden in my backyard. I've been growing a lot of beets and Swiss chard. I do a big pickled beet recipe, and the chard is great because you can harvest it through the whole season. Last summer, it was the first time that I had a problem with this, but I had some problems with the leaf miners. And I'm just looking for any kind of like organic advice beyond just picking the leaves and, disposing of them elsewhere. And I did get a beet harvest, but I've heard of some people who had really poor beet harvest this year because of the problem.
Okay, Erin.
And I'm not sure how much the problem might change from year to year. So this year you may have had an issue and next year you may not have an issue. But the leaf miner itself is actually a larvae that's then after an egg hatches, an adult fly, which is a small black or gray fly, will land on the leaf. The female will feed on the plant sap and lay eggs within the leaf tissue. And then after 2 to 4 days, those eggs will hatch. And that's where you'll see the larvae feeding and making those distinct lines where they're mining through the leaves. So John and I think that perhaps row cover to try to exclude those adult flies may help. Neem would be a organic pesticide that you could use. Unfortunately, that product wouldn't help with that current generation, so you'd still see those mines, but it would help with subsequent generations and a continued problem, perhaps, or continued issue with them. But since they are flies laying eggs on the leaves, perhaps excluding with row cover would be a solution.
Yeah, and we've mentioned row cover a bunch of times in the show today, so it's probably worth explaining to people what that is. Yeah. It's a spun polyester fiber fabric that lets in sunlight and moisture, but can exclude pests. And the other thing it can do is it can lengthen your growing season because it's a little bit warmer under the row cover mm-hmm. than outside the row cover.
So I think John mentioned this when we were talking about squash bugs, but for crops that do need pollination, you do need to make sure to remove that row cover when you need the honeybees or other pollinators to come in to move that pollen from flower to flower. But with crops like you're talking about with the leafy greens, they are a great solution for pest problems that are on leafy vegetables.
Great.
All right.
That sounds like a good option. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Ken in McHenry, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Hello. A couple of comments. The mushroom compost has a lot of urea in it. It's very rich, too rich for most applications. And on the broccoli, the little worms in broccoli and Brussels sprouts and stuff, I found diatomaceous earth to work really good. Of course, it's broad range, just like the BT, so it's going to kill anything that comes in, you know, any caterpillar, so you can kill other butterflies also that way. But taking post-harvest, if you'll just soak your broccoli in some salt water for a little while, the worms will float right out, and you don't end up having to eat them. And that's it.
Thank you very much for calling. And the diatomaceous earth idea?
I'm not really familiar with diatomaceous earth.
Well, diatomaceous earth is basically,
like razor blades.
it kills caterpillars that crawl across it. So, you know, on the little Brussels sprouts, I don't know if you'd be able to get good coverage of the surface of those to actually prevent those little worms from getting inside those heads and doing their damage. So it may be effective more effective on a crop like cabbage than on Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, I would not put it on the plant itself. I mean, I just for the sake of not, you'd want to make darn sure that you cleaned it very carefully after the fact if you put it right straight on the plant. I was thinking of putting it on the ground around the plant, so when they're crawling to the plant.
Right, but most of those cabbage slooper butterflies are—they're not laying their eggs in the soil. They're laying their eggs on the leaves so that their young can start eating right away. So I'm not sure that diatomaceous earth is going to work for that.
Yeah. Yep. Rick and Ellsworth, thanks for calling. Hi.
Yeah. Hi. See, I just have a question on Creeping Charlie and asparagus. I have about 100 asparagus plants that we planted. But we've also got Creeping Charlie that came in and is now really covering and seems to be taking over, you know, the ground. And I'm just wondering, I mean, if I leave the Creeping Charlie, will that harm the asparagus? Or is there a way to get rid of that Creeping Charlie without doing damage?
You know how I get rid of it? I get my daughter out there, and she and I get down on our hands and knees, and we just start pulling it. And you would be amazed at how much Creeping Charlie you can get rid of in an hour.
Okay. It's,
I mean, literally, you get one or two people out there, and you're not going to get rid of all of it, but it takes a long time for it to come back. If you really pull, you know, if you really do a good job of pulling, it takes a long, you know, it's going to come back, unfortunately. But that's what I've done in my lawn, and you can imagine how hard it is to get it out of a lawn.
Right.
But, Aaron, what do you think?
Well, I would, that's what my family does on our lawn as well. And I think perhaps if you were to heavily mulch that after the asparagus has been harvested and keep it mulched through the rest of the season, that would help smother it and perhaps have that Creeping Charlie use resources to try to get through the mulch and be less susceptible to or less apt to come back if you are continually trying to pull it up throughout the summer.
Yeah, the word that comes to mind is persistence.
Yeah.
You just have to stay after that. There's no Creeping Charlie is just, you know, like one of the worst plants ever.
It's the remaining effects of some rhubarb that I had from my grandmother that when I planted the rhubarb, I got the Creeping Charlie with. And so I was just like,
nuts.
So I still have the rhubarb, though, so that's good.
Well, yeah, you want to keep grandma's rhubarb. There'd be no...
Right.
I think Aaron's right. Persistent pulling, and then follow that with heavy mulching to try to keep it at more at bay.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. I wonder, someone else had wondered just about getting an asparagus bed started and had trouble getting it started. And any advice on that? John, you've got asparagus, haven't you?
I do have a small amount of asparagus, mainly just for home use. I had trouble getting it started, too. I lost a number of the crowns when I planted them. There's lots of resources online about the correct planting method, making a trench and setting the crowns in and then filling them up. Again, getting that crown at the right height and filling in the soil, not all at once, but over a period of time.
Yeah, and I remember telling my dad that and explaining, and at the same time I was putting in an asparagus bed, he was putting one in too, and he ignored all my advice and just kind of stuck them in the ground, and he has had this wonderful asparagus bed, and mine that was planted the quote correct way, I didn't get a very good result. And he was a good enough guy that he didn't remind me about it either. So that was good. Chris in Two Rivers. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yes, I got an interesting project that I've done starting new gardens. Is I find a local farmer who raises pigs, and you can get these full 40-pound pigs and put them in the area for about a month. They will rototill that garden up better than you can ever do by hand, and I didn't have weeds for 3 years.
Good for you, Chris. Although not all of us live close to a pig farm.
Yeah, it's one of those things. If you're living out in the country, it's easy. But in town, I realize it's pretty hard to do.
But I love the idea. Thanks, Chris. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, it's like there are people who use goats to get rid of invasives. Mm-hmm. I mean, the goats will eat anything. And
and there's weeder geese, too, and chickens. And, yeah, I know that there's a whole host of livestock you can use for weeding.
Matt in Milwaukee. Hi, thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have a 17-year-old son that's a high school senior, and he's expressed an interest in botany. And unfortunately, he just got rejected by the University of Wisconsin, and we're wondering, how we can help him down that path if he stays interested in the subject. What we can do to help him pursue a degree, and what careers might be available to him after getting an education in biology or botany.
You know, Matt, one of the things you can do here, now I'm an advisor you guys probably are too, an advisor at the university here, and so I work with a lot of students. And one thing, if your son was didn't make it into the UW-Madison, let's say, is where he was applying, you can, he could go to Milwaukee Area Technical College or Madison Area College, and take a lot of his introductory courses, and if he goes for 2 years and maintains a B or better average, he is automatically accepted into the UW-Madison and into the UW system. And so he could go to one of the tech colleges, take his courses that are sort of basic intro courses. And frankly, the schools do a very good job on those intro courses and some of the advanced ones, obviously, too. But it's a great way to get started. And I've had advisees who have come from Madison College, Madison Area Technical College, who have done very well once they got to the UW-Madison, as long as, you know, like anything, I've had some that did and some that didn't, but sort of your state of mind, but it's definitely something I would consider if he's really interested in that area. And Aaron, anything to add?
Yeah, I would agree. I'm a proud UW Stevens Point grad that worked in the summers at different programs, different research projects in applied agriculture at UW-Madison. So there's definitely opportunities at other UW schools or at other technical colleges, and then engage in agriculture either at UW-Madison or some of our research stations throughout the state. And there definitely are careers in applied biology and applied agriculture, which I think are very exciting because you can really get out there and see your work make a difference in agriculture and on the Wisconsin landscape. And there's opportunities to engage working with farmers, working through different industries that are associated with farming and other areas of botany as well. So I think there still are ways to, without being involved directly in UW-Madison, to get experience in botany and applied agriculture, and I would encourage him to do so.
Yeah.
Sure. One follow-up on that.
Sure.
You said you graduated from Stevens Point. What are some of the, I've heard that they have a good program. What are the various other UW schools that we might consider?
Platteville and River Falls are the two that have agriculture programs. So if he's interested in the applied aspects of botany, those are two other UW schools.
Yeah. He's more of an environmental, has more of an environmental interest. Possibly UW Green Bay would be another. If it's sort of environment and plants, that would definitely be one of the colleges, university campuses I'd look to. So there
Great.
You go. Yeah. Thanks. He's got lots of, and I'll tell you what, have him, if he has questions, have him shoot me an email.
I will do that.
I'd be happy to. I've talked with all kinds of students who are still in high school about their goals, and my email is Miller, M-E-I-L-L-E-R, at wisc.edu, 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 as we always say.
Thank you.
Yeah. No problem. Glad to help. We have all kinds of questions, I believe, here that have come in on Facebook and on our. Let's see, what do we got here? Oh, how about this comment from Gail in Oshkosh? Please talk about how to plant leeks and keep them growing throughout the growing season. What about leeks? I never really planted leeks, to be perfectly honest. That's green onions.
Yeah, that's a different plant, though.
That's a different
pretty
plant.
Much, planting is pretty similar. There's primarily two main ways to plant leeks. One way is, both ways involve growing transplants. So, and then leeks are relatively slow growing, so you've got to start them quite early indoors, no later than March. And when you plant, you either want to create a trench and plant them in the bottom of that trench and then gradually fill in that trench so you have a nice white blanched stem. Or if you don't want to build the trench, you can plant them at as you would normally, and then hill them periodically like you would hill potatoes in order to get that blanched stem.
All right. Here's kind of an interesting email from, a master gardener, and it has to do with squash bugs. They're a continued issue at the community garden, which I coordinate for the Ozaukee Master Gardeners. We've learned the following. End-of-season cleanup is an absolute must. Better yet, remove plants if they fall to an infestation earlier in the growing season. All right. Rotate the plants if space allows. Point three, seedlings or seeds planted after June 1st have a pretty good chance of surviving a bug attack, since the first generations of bugs will come and go before the plant is at the tasty stage for the bug, which I've heard that as well. It's a very good tip. At the first sign of a bug presence, small brown seeds on the back side of the leaves, remove the leaf and squash the eggs. So there we have
it. That comment about small brown seeds, the eggs look like small brown seeds. They're not seeds, they're eggs.
Right.
Just to clarify.
Yeah. And that's from Mary in West Bend, Wisconsin. And you guys agree with all that?
Well, that's what I do
Absolutely.
In my home garden. It's sometimes just as easy with pests like squash bugs or Colorado potato beetle, just to try to manage them by hand. And if you see those eggs, remove them, squash them, and keep another generation from hatching.
Thanks again, Mary, for that. Carolyn emailed and said at least half our potato crop last year had tiny black holes that went an inch or more deep, and the flesh around that area was black and hard. There was no decay like you'd expect with a burrowing insect. What do you think? That's not one that I've come in contact with.
I don't grow enough potatoes to have experienced that, so I'm afraid I don't know what that is.
Somebody else may have an idea about what that is, but Aaron, nothing comes to mind for you?
Yeah, and when I was out in Washington State, a wireworm might come to mind, but I'm not sure how widespread of a pest that is in Wisconsin.
Facebook comment from Jennifer: Long Island cheese pumpkins grow great in Wisconsin. I planted them for the last 2 years and get a great crop with no effort. I got my seeds from St. Clair Heirloom Seeds.
That's the most common variety in terms of these cheese pumpkins that are being talked about. The Long Island cheese is the most common one.
We do a lot of squash trials as part of my research program, and Long Island cheese is something that we include because it stores for an incredibly long time. So if you're looking for something that will last throughout the winter that you can put in storage, Long Island cheese is a great choice.
And listener Rick has heard that basalt rock dust can be used to add minerals to the soil. Do you do it?
No, with a lot of these rock dusts, and I'm not familiar with basalt rock dust, but other similar sorts of amendments, they take a long time to weather and for those nutrients to be released. So it's not something that you're going to see immediate result from. And again, I'm not familiar with basalt rock dust, so I can't speak specifically on that. But like other sorts of rock dust, they're not something that you're going to see available to the plant immediately.
And I want to get back to the School for Beginning Market Growers. This is a three-day event, and it's for people who are interested in maybe commercially selling their garden produce.
That's right. It's for people who want to start a business growing and marketing fresh produce. People who are going to want to sell at farmers markets, or perhaps they want to do a CSA mm-hmm. in their community or sell to local chefs.
And it's for over a three-day period.
Yep. All day for 3 days. You spend 3 days with myself and three experienced growers who share all the ins and outs of what it takes to start a business. Lots of hands-on practical advice. Then we have some of our university specialists like Aaron come in and give targeted talks as well.
So it's a really good experience. I mean, if you're at all thinking about getting into this, or maybe if you're already in it or just getting started, it probably worth the...
Oh, sure. We usually have some people in the class that are, you know, maybe they've had a year or two in, but still feel like they've got a long way to go in order to make it a solid, successful business.
So it's the School for Beginning Market Growers. And if you go to our Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, you're going to get a link to it right there. And or if you just put in UW School for Beginning Market Growers, it's probably going to just pop up.
Absolutely.
On the page. John, Aaron, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Always great to think about vegetables and growing on the first day of the year, or I guess the second day of the year.
I want to go home and make some up, cook some up. That's what I'm going to do this evening. That's what I'm going to have. I don't know what. Maybe some asparagus. There's some asparagus out there. It's not local, but you know what? It'll taste good. John Hendrickson and Aaron Silva from the UW-Madison College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at the UW-Madison. Monday at 11, we'll be broadcasting Governor Walker's inauguration.